fiction is its own unique thing. It has its own special engine that can't really be replicated, I don't think. That we can't really replicate it. Somebody else might be like, "Oh, that's not true." It's, you know, this is how you write, and you know, this is how it has to be done. And that's true, I think, for certain genres. Like we think of romance, for example, very typical structure. You know, you have to follow it. The reader's expecting something to be a certain way. And for me, that's just not how I write. I can't plan. I have to kind of just, you know, last night I was talking about this book's journey into existence, and it was kind of random and made no sense really until I made sense of it. And that's how I approach fiction. I think approaching fiction that way, with not too much guidance on what you're doing, is good, because you stumble upon things in the same way we stumble upon things in life, and I think that helps give fiction a bit of a boost. But that's not to say we can't focus in, get specific with craft elements, right? Like, when I'm writing, you know, I'm thinking about character, I'm thinking about setting and place, I'm thinking about tension and conflict and plot also. But I always am very, very conscious of character. And I think, you know, people talk about fiction as, there's two forms, you know, there's this character-driven stories, and then there's, like, plot-driven stories, and I really don't see a difference between it, because plot and character are so sort of intertwined in my mind. You know, it's the characters who are either, I guess the picture I always draw on the board is, like, a little stick figure, and I have arrows pointing outward, which means the character's doing something which is causing consequences that need reconciliation, and you get an arc sort of thing. But then you also have external actions, right? A tornado hits somebody's house, right? And then there's the wreckage you have to pick up. And I'm not saying those are the two types of plots that exist, but if we think about, like, how many people struggle with writer's block? Bless you if you don't. Yeah. I had a professor once who was like, writer's block just means you're depressed. you're depressed, you have writer's block, yeah. And so I experienced writer's block before I really kind of understood what it was or how I came to understand it. And this goes back to thinking about character. And it's like, if you're opening a blank page and you don't know where to start, just have a character do something. Come up with somebody. It doesn't have to be good. The most important part is we get somebody who does something. You know, they're walking down the street and they save a cat from, you know, a gutter, you know, a bunch of kittens from a gutter. I don't know why my example always has to do with robbing banks. Somebody robs a bank. And, there are consequences to those things. And as a writer, it's easy enough, if we pay attention to that, the story begins to tell itself, right? We start to say, oh, okay, well, if he robs the bank, he gets away. And then what, right? Like, what are his options, logical options? There's a logic to the decisions that people make, and, you know, that's reflected in who they are, what they value. Even, you know, with that, though, when characters do something that says something about who they are, right, and it sort of creates a sense of emotion for the reader, right? We have a reaction to who this person is. And I think that's the point in writing where we want to evince that emotion. Because for me, you know, I think, is anyone familiar with Ocean Vuong's work, the poet and mm-hmm. he read the novelist? Yeah, he had this wonderful piece in the New Yorker, I think it was, where basically he said, he's like, when I read, I feel more alive. And I think that's the point of storytelling, is to, you know, once something has been rendered and written and revised, you know, you read it, and not only do you, if the writer's done their job, you feel as if you've lived that, you know, you feel as if that's become a memory, but you have sort of, you've taken some of that emotion that'll always be with you, and it's sort of made you fuller And that, I think, is like, we don't, I think we live in a time where it's all about big things happening, right? You pick up any explosive book that sells well, it's because something big happened, you know. It isn't because somebody, you know, it isn't because of some specific emotion. It's, you know, some type of Michael Bay film, you know, with like trucks spiraling out of control. But the thing is what makes readers, what makes a work accessible to readers is a lot of factors, but I think the biggest one is emotion. Because if we take out all of the aspects of storytelling, if we take away, you know, the stuff we put in there, like culture or, you know, ethnicity, you know, background, experiences, if you strip all of that away, the one commonality that will always remain and can cross any boundary is the fact that we all can feel, right? We know what it is to be sad. We know what it is to be happy, unless you're a psychopath. You know, we know what it is to be, you know, overjoyed, depressed, hopefully not, but elated, all of these feelings. And if we approach a story and we try to find characters who are evincing those emotions, then we can start to build on top of it, because you've established a connection now between the reader and the character. And I didn't really think about this until after my book came out, and a lot of people who I would not expect to relate to the book related to the book. And I think it has a lot to do with my having put so much emphasis on emotion as being the foundation upon which you build the rest of the story. And I think that's one of the reasons why the book, so many people didn't see the book as this atrocious sort of like, let's tell a sad story and make, you know, and put money in your pockets because you made me cry type of thing. You know, like, I think that's why the book worked, is because it was two separate entities. You know, the trauma in the book, or the trauma in any story really that I work on, isn't the engine itself that drives the story. Because if it is, then for me, I feel like I'm making something that's misery porn, essentially, you know, and would probably sell really well, you know, because people love that stuff. But it's, you know, it's about the emotion, and it's about the, it's about not exploiting the, I don't know, the terrible, so to speak, for the sake of making somebody feel a certain way. A writer who is was notorious for it, and there are a lot of them out there, but Sherman Alexie, who is obviously no longer a literary figure because of the way he treated women and was abusive, but he had some good stories that were, you know, good, that I didn't feel were malicious, but he had a lot of stories which preyed on sort of what you would call exoticized foreknowledge, you know, what people bring to the page about a specific people, in this case, indigenous people. And he has this, has anyone read The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fist Fight in Heaven? It says it was his first book that came out. Well, he had his poetry come out, but it was his first fiction that came out. And he has a story in it called Every Little Hurricane. And the protagonist goes, the narrator says, because it's third person, the narrator says, Victor watched his father cry huge, gasping tears, Indian tears. And you read it, and I think if you're not native, you know, if I ask you, like, what does that represent? What do Indian tears represent?
I would say, like, Indians suffered more, and so they're
tragedy.
Really,
yeah.
Like, they really can
evoke. Yeah, and so it's associated with just this general idea that we carry, that we know, right? It doesn't come specifically from that character, right? Mm-hmm. So this is, Sherman Alexie was great at doing these kind of literary cheat codes, so to speak, right? To make you feel, right? He would drop in, you know, Indian tears, and native readers would be like, okay, I know what you mean there. Non-native readers would feel it in a specific way. That emotion wouldn't come from the story itself, The emotion would come from what you bring to the story, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but in this case, it doesn't really deepen the character in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
It just turns them into this caricature that, you know, it's just simply... it's simply maintaining what you know about Indigenous people, right? And so, fiction for me is about emotion at its, like, very basic core. I always want to use, like, science metaphors, but I don't know anything about science, really. Like, it's like at its atom level, or, like, molecular level, like, that's what you want to go after. And I know we have poets here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like poetry has a larger understanding of that sense of emotion, you know, pushing forward a poem. And I always imagine it on like a spectrum. There's like poetry, fiction, nonfiction, not good or bad in any order whatsoever. But stories are about feeling. Like that's the one, that's the thing that makes us, you know, connect with the literature. And so that's how I approach every story. Any questions, or does anyone want to talk about?
Yeah. It made me think of the sort of the old adage that they teach you in poetry is show, don't tell.
Yeah.
You know, so everything is sort of organically generated from.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, the big, you know, one of the big things is, I think, of generating that, in fiction, generating that emotion is specificity,
mm-hmm.
you know, being... being as specific as you can while not overwhelming the reader with, you know, the senses, because if you do that, they're not going to be able to focus, there's going to be too much there. You know, that's one of the things I cut most in my students' work is specificity. Either it's like way too much, where it is just like burying you, and, or there's not enough. And I think a good example is Raymond Carver was, his short fiction was very good, but I think one of the reasons why a lot of it failed to reach sort of these transcendental moments was because he wasn't as specific. Like, I feel like he fell into the trap of so much minimalism, or you can say Gordon Lish did it, you know, had taken so much out that, you know, the senses and the specificity of a place, and that's the other thing, is place itself is also reciprocating it onto character. But that his stories kind of fell and didn't really, you know, they were good stories, but they didn't quite get over that hump. They didn't become metaphors. There wasn't a sense that you felt more alive after reading it. You just kind of were like, well, that was interesting. You know what I mean? Like it felt like a fleeting moment, which is fine. You know, it's not everything we have to read has to blow your hair off and off, you know, but, you know, he's an example of just somebody I point to all the time who, you know, through not having the senses as specifically grounded and well-crafted, it doesn't work. It's a story, but it's competent, you know what I mean? And it's competent and it does what it needs to do, but then he has other ones, you know, like The Cathedral, you know, and all these stories that are very specific and grounded and in place that, you know, were like, oh, I feel different now, I feel changed. But yeah, sensory details are such an important aspect to, or showing, I should say, you know, showing is an important thing. And that's not to say telling. I find it interesting. I feel like there's telling. I feel like there's two kinds of telling. There's telling, where it's almost just like you're being told everything, but then there's telling that feels like showing, you know what I mean? And then there's showing where it's seen and it's unfolding. You want to do the second and third one.
And like Indian Tears is telling.
Yeah, Indian Tears is like that first telling. Like it's not doing anything. It's just dangling it there in front of the reader, and victimizing, you know, the character and creating a sense of pity. But other thoughts. Yeah.
I was curious about your views on that emotion, of course, being the core. But your stories they have such marvelous dialogue, you know, and how do you see the intersection of those parts of the story with the welling up of the emotion somehow?
Yeah, I think, you mean with the use of dialogue?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, dialogue, I love dialogue. I mean, like I said, I think last night, I think I said this, you know, like I grew up not being very much of a reader, but I loved hearing stories and I loved telling stories. And so I've always had this like orality, you know, this understanding of it. And I always just loved hearing what people would say. Like it was just, I have, you know, I keep a list in my phone of just stuff that people say or ideas that come to me, but people say some funny stuff and you're able to, you know, use it eventually. And with dialogue, you know, I think dialogue is, I think, the closest we get to being immersed. And like for me, it is, because it's literally the words of a character, right? Like it's the way we're communicating. It's the way we communicate, and you're one of the ways we communicate. And so dialogue is always this, dialogue is tricky. There's writers who really like don't, who like great writers who like don't use it because they'll say they don't know how to do it, but I think they're just afraid not to do it. They're afraid to do it. I'm thinking of, is anyone familiar with the writer Rick Bass?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he I mean, he uses dialogue occasionally, but I was talking to him and he was like, because he was a mentor of mine, so he was always very impressed with my use of dialogue. And so he was like, I'm envious of your use of dialogue. And I'm like, and I look at, you know, writers like him and I'm like, well, I'm envious of everything else you're doing in your, you know what I mean? So we can go back and forth at this, but dialogue, like any other aspect of fiction or not in nonfiction and poetry, it has its like set sort of rules that we expect to see, right? And I think the biggest one to sort of, and this depends on genre too, but the biggest one is that dialogue isn't this, or shouldn't be this one-to-one ratio, right? Like it shouldn't be, hey, Tim, how are you? I'm good, John, how are you? I'm fine, thanks to see you. Hey, by the way, do you got that money? You know, we have this gradual building, but, and it's not bad, you know, it's not terrible, but what happens if you cut two lines and you go, hey, John, how are you? And it's like, Mike, do you have my money, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have this one-to-one ratio. Instead, we have this sort of like zipper type of effect, and we can feel from that. We're like, oh, you know, it's like listening to somebody, it's like, if somebody just came in here and you were like, hey, Mike, how you doing? And then they asked you, like, where's my money? And they didn't say hi back or anything, you know, like everyone in the room would feel that tension, right? Would feel that emotion. And so with dialogue, it's about finding those opportunities, I think, to take away in order to make it feel like something's there, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I've always sort of compared it to, like, the way I write is it's like, it'll be like a painting, and my theory is like, okay, how much of this painting can I erase while it is still legible, that you can still see it and know what's there? You erase part of like a horse, and you know there's part of a horse, but you know there's also a full horse, right? That's the same with dialogue. It's like cutting, and it can be conversational in short fiction. Novels, you tend, I think, to see dialogue that stretches more one-to-one ratio because of its length. Short fiction tends to be weirder, I think, with dialogue and the way it gets away and the way characters talk. But I say that, but in my book, my characters have, you know, full-on conversations. And I just like having characters talk because it feels like you're really being pulled into the moment, into that narrative. It's, like I said, it's the closest you get to being in scene with the characters. And so it's looking for opportunities like that, but it's also looking for opportunities to feed off the dialogue by using exposition or narrative interjecting, you know, having the narrator come in with a thought, using indirect dialogue, right? Like, you know, not having it in dialogue, but having it in exposition. You know, it's like, hey, did you go to the bar last night? And it's like, he told him yes, and he told him everything. You know what I mean? And just, you know,
yeah,
finding that pace. It's, you know, for me, it's always been like trying to find this perfect balance between, you know, setting and character and dialogue, and, you know, where does it work? Where is it not working? It's like building having a bunch of oddly shaped blocks and trying to, you know, build them right.
Yeah.
But yeah, dialogue, I think, for me, is my favorite part.
Yes,
because it's
so,
like,
so good.
It's just,
you can infer so much from what you write. You know, it's so sparse that you can infer from previous parts of the book or the story.
Yeah, and I think it's, I just grew up like always I think the biggest thing for a writer to practice dialogue is to read dialogue a lot, you know, and to see how it's like working on the page, but also just to listen to people. Like, I remember, like, in undergrad and in high school, and anywhere really, I was always very quiet, but I was always listening, you know, how people were talking, how they were saying things, and it's just, I don't know, I do this once in a while, but you just sit there and you just listen to what people are talking about, and it's like, oh, they're in trouble, no, you shouldn't do that, you know, and you're thinking about everything going on, but I always have my students, you know, I'm like, your assignment is to go sit in the cafeteria and just listen to people talk, you know, or to go, I was in a workshop once, and there was a sliding glass door, the bottom part was like, clouded, and then the top part was like see-through, and these two businessmen walked by, they looked very like professional, just sort of just walked by, and one of them stopped, the other kept going, and the other bent down, and you just see his silhouette behind the clouded clouded glass, and then he comes back up and he goes, yep, that's a shit. I don't know what compelled him to bend down and take a whiff of. He could have easily left be, but he didn't. But like that's the stuff that's funny, and you know it doesn't even need to be. You know, you can just let it be. You know, like if you're using, you know, you have characters passing by, just a regular person, and you know they. Or characters not in the story, and you still want them to feel real, and that can come through dialogue, you know, having them say something, or having them do something. Anthony Doerr is, like, a genius at this. I imagine everyone's read All the Light We Cannot See.
Yes.
If you haven't, I highly recommend it. But there's this moment where they bring the German boy, the orphan, to some lieutenant, Nazi lieutenant's house or something, because they find out that he's smart and he's building radios and stuff, and inside there's a guard, and then there's the lieutenant, and then there's the person who chaperoned the boy, and I'll never forget this, it just blew me away, just how smart of a choice this was. The lieutenant's offering the boy cake, and there's these people in the room. And you get a sense, okay, so this lieutenant's offering cake. There's this gesture here. There's this sense of expectation, reciprocity, you know, being owed something. And the guard is standing there, and you would think, oh, well, we just have this two-dimensional or one-dimensional character. Like, they're there to guard it. But Doerr made the deliberate choice to go, you know, he cut the cake for the boy or something like that. And then he goes, the guard's eyes flick to the cake and then back forward again. And it's just its own line, right? But it tells you everything, right? And behind that is desire, which is like with emotion is in fiction. A lot of it, I think, comes from what characters want, right? You know, I think stories tend to fail when we don't know what it is the characters want, what they want to have, what they don't want to have. And that guard, you know, he wanted just a piece of cake, you know, and you can even go further than that and be like, oh, he wants, you know, I don't want to say the cake is a metaphor for anything, it's cake, but, you know, he wants something more, right, that he's not being offered, and, you know, just one sentence, yet it tells you everything you need to know about this character you'll never see again in the book, and so I feel like that's how we should treat all of our characters, because... God, I remember that guard almost as good as I remember, you know, the blind girl and you know, the German boy. But, and again, all of that is through specificity and seeing something in a way nobody else is able to see it, which takes time, right, and which takes effort, and we can't always do. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up what characters want, because Mia printed out a little packet of stuff for us, and it was an interview you did for The Atlantic, and you said that same thing about you be- being involved with the characters and what characters wanted and what they would do to get it. And I started thinking about that, and I feel like one of the things you do really brilliantly in your stories, and I don't know how you do it, really, is that you know what the characters want, but I feel like the characters don't totally know what they want. And you somehow convey that. You make the reader kind of know what the character wants when the character doesn't know it themselves.
Yeah, I think... I don't know how... I wish I could tell you how I do that. And to be honest, I might not even know that I do it that way.
Well, it's sort of a belief.
I think it's just because, you know, I feel like a writer's job, obviously, is to, like, write and to sit down and, you know, to revise and all this stuff. But it's also to, like, really observe, like, really be, like, present in the moment and living life. And I think, you know, I inadvertently, growing up, was just very quiet. So I was always, like, watching. I was always seeing. And, you know, I knew what it was people wanted or what I ever felt they wanted. And I think that translates well to storytelling, because you're kind of just a little step ahead, right, in literary fiction of the characters. But, yeah, I don't know how I do it. It's just sort of, I think it tends to be a byproduct of doing other things, you know, which I think is an important thing to talk about, too, is it's like we can't do, you know, all these craft elements, like, we can't do them all at once. Like, we can't, I think it was John Gardner who was like that, it's like trying to juggle, like, 50 things at once. That's why drafting and revising is so important, is like that first draft, you juggle 3 things and drop a couple, and then, you know, you go back to it and you pick up the balls and you're like, oh, well, I've already juggled these ones, I don't need them, and then you start juggling them again, and you're, you know, this time, this pass through, you're working on the way setting interacts with character. You know, the next time you're working on desire because you couldn't quite work on it when you're doing it. Like, it was too much. It was overloading you. And, like, writing is really rewriting, right? It's, you know, starting over again if you have to. And not being afraid to do that. My novel that's coming out in the summer, I wrote the first draft, which I then threw away and then started over because it just I thought I had failed, but really I had just figured things out. And it really became like this 400-page sort of like mess of people's lives. And then I kind of knew them, and so when I started over again, it was so much easier because it was like they were real. It was like I knew them. I knew everything I needed about them. I knew everything I needed to know about them, but still learned. And so starting over is, it's any piece of writing, nothing is a failure, is what I say, is what I think. You know, there are, you know, in the book, Food for the Common Cold, for example, would not exist if I hadn't written this 30-page story that in no way, shape, or form looks like Food for the Common Cold. I wrote this 30-page story, and on the outskirts, I was like thinking there was this weird tension between Mom and Frick about wanting a child, and I was like, okay, what if I take that and go? But I wouldn't have figured that out if I hadn't have written those 30 pages, which is why I think it's, you know, important to write and fail a lot of the times, because that failure is.
Yeah, no, it does. It's like,
you know, yeah, because you have so many different stories, because you know who they are, and you know who they are not, and that's the important thing, is because if you've written 40 pages of, quote-unquote, failed material of, you know, characters, you've learned who they are and who they're not. Mm-hmm. You know, this person isn't, you know, a drug addict. This person doesn't love their job, or, oh, this person actually does love their job, and it helps you, I think, when you take those characters and put them in situations
to have those situations feel actually real, you know. And so I've always, and just, you know, for every story there's, you know, so many pages that just like did not, you know, appear. And I imagine that's the case for a lot of you here. And then there's those jerks out there who just sit down and like write a story from start to finish. I think Anton Chekhov was one. He would like take a bath and like write like a story.
The killers.
But yeah, for the rest of us mortals, we have to slave away.
Well, I really liked what you were saying last night about Phyllis being a character that you don't really know, and it made me wonder, like, did you try to write more about Phyllis and realize that you were just sort of imposing it on a character and that you didn't really know? I mean, it just made me wonder about writing that character.
Yeah, he was, you know, the moment he came onto the page, I could not control him. Like, I'll experiment occasionally, but like, all right, let me try to write first person from this character's point of view, just to see if I have, if I'm able to inhabit them in a writerly way. And Phyllis was just one I could never do. Like, it was like I would get in his mind, and it would just shut off. It was like he, whatever, this sounds like super, like, spiritual, whatever he is, whatever entity he is, he doesn't want to be, like, known very well. Only by what you see through D. And I think there's always this, like, there's a practicalness that comes to learning to write, but then there's also this deep sort of mysticism is the wrong word, but I want to use it anyways. Mysticism around the idea of story. Like, for me, like, if we didn't exist, you know, and if humans didn't live on this earth, story would still exist. Mm-hmm. You know, there would still be the arc of it, even in a, you know, premature, smaller version. Like, story would still happen, right? You know, an animal would be trying to live, would be trying to get food, and then, you know, predator would go after it, it would run, you know, there would be arcs, you know? So, it's not like we invented story, I don't think. We discovered it as a means to learn or know something, you know, and in that respect, if it's something outside of our control, then I think we have to recognize at times that it is out of our control. And I think a lot of stories fail because we want to impose on the story, you know, we want the story to be a certain way, and some stories just don't want to be that way, right? You know, so Food for the Common Cold, I'd written that 30-page story that didn't want to be that way, and it started posing this question that I saw, this tension between these characters, and I listened to it, and then I found, you know, Food for the Calm and Cold. So I think story isn't this thing we've invented. You know, we've invented how to use it and have tweaked it a little bit, but it's there regardless, and it's sort of sacred, right? Like, we have to treat it as so, even with all the writers telling us how to write, you know? You know, even though we're sitting here talking about writing and saying what you should and shouldn't do. But yeah, story has its own agenda, I think. Yeah.
I like that you say that, because I'm thinking of and wondering if you were at all influenced by the storytelling at the school. I'm thinking John Bear Mitchell, who was the Native Studies teacher there. And I used to go and try to listen to his stories about Glooskap, which I couldn't very often because I was supposed to be working. But I would do it whenever I could. And I thought they were wonderful. He made those stories so funny and accessible. And I don't know if you were, I mean, you were there for years. So
yeah.
Do you see that as part of an influence? Because he made those funny.
Yeah, I definitely do. I think him. Mean, he's a great storyteller, and he's a great storyteller. And I never saw myself as like a storyteller in that capacity, because he was very, you know, there's like a sense of acting that goes with it, with Guskabe and Grandmother Woodchuck and all of these characters. And but that's how I grew up, was like on those stories.
Yeah.
But also, you know, my mother's stories, my grandmother's stories, my sister's stories, my father's stories, you know, the things I saw and the things I told, and, you know, my mother was, I think, I feel like I learned a lot about storytelling from my mother, because she, and for fiction anyway, let's just say it for fiction, because something would happen, you know, like I'd go, my mother had a temper, like no others, and like we would go to the grocery store, and like, if someone hit her cart, there would be a fight. Not like a physical fight, but like a argument. And I'll just share the story with you. One night, a bunch of kids were walking up our road, and they were barking at our dog. And my mother thought it would be appropriate to go out and shoot at him with a BB gun. That's the type of person my mother was. She was impulsive, and somehow managed to not get arrested after that. And but got my BB gun taken away. But she would, you know, something would happen and I would have been there with her. And then she would be on the phone with one of my aunts telling them how it happened. And I'm listening, and I'm like, oh, yep, that happened. But then I'm like, I don't recall that happening. I don't recall that happening. But it was so convincing that I was even like, did that happen? I was like, did I help her get the keys out from under the, like, what? She was very good at lying in a way that wasn't really harmful, like with storytelling, and like wasn't abusive. And my father also was a liar, like a really bad liar, but he would never tell the truth. Like, you could catch him on camera and he'd be like, yeah, ain't me. And he really would. He would not say that was him. But it was witnessing those things that really, I think,
okay,
taught me, you know, this, or influenced my writing deeply. You know, those, or like hearing people talk, hearing people, you know, tell stories and spin them in their own ways.
Well, that it's not just what happens.
Yes.
There's more to it than that.
Yeah.
I feel like teaching, that's always a really hard thing to get your students, or some students, to grasp. Is like, they'll be like, no, I can't take that out, that's what really happened. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, you've got what really happened, then you've got your story.
Yeah.
It's getting beyond reality.
Yeah, it's like, how do you capture the truth? You know what I mean? How do you capture the truth that's factual or true, or that is true, but you're lying about getting there. There's this really fascinating book, I'm not sure if people have read, but it's called The Lifespan of a Fact by John DeGotta and Jim Fingal. And John DeGotta is an essayist, and he had been commissioned to write a story about a boy who committed suicide in Las Vegas. And it was an essay, it was like a color piece for this magazine. And they assigned a fact checker to it, and the book is formatted with the essay in the middle on every page, and then around it is red text, which is conversations between the fact checker and Jim Fingal.
Mm-hmm.
And like, there were just so many discrepancies, and here we get the artistic
license.
Yeah, artistic license, and you know, like what we're able to do. And he was like, oh, well, I changed, you know, the color of the carpet because it matched the mood better, you know, the carpet that led up to the roof where this young man committed suicide. And it's like, okay, well, that's fair, I guess. I don't think anyone's gonna be mad that you went and changed the color of the carpet, but these three events you're talking about, you know, were national moments, didn't occur on the same day, you know. You know, like, we want to be a little factual here. But it's an interesting book to see at what point a story might break, you know. And every magazine has its own sort of like ethical approach to how much you can bend the truth, so to speak, right? But that you know, has always been sort of this, like, they ended up not publishing the piece because it was so, there had been so many artistic liberties taken in it. But then they published the book, and it's really fascinating. And John DeGotta has a lot to say and fight about in this piece.
Good question. You have so much in your life, it sounds like, and a new job too. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And how do you find the time, and how do you structure your time in order to find time for your own writing?
I'm still figuring that out now with the baby. But it's about, you know, it's about, you know, I'm fortunate in that my wife is, you know, my wife stays home and takes care of Charlie and is a stay-at-home mom, and so I have that, you know, I'm very fortunate that she's there, you know, so I can be like, hey, I gotta go write. And, you know, when I was doing revisions for my novel, you know, there was a week where I was just in my office all day, and, but then after that, you know, the next 2 weeks was, you know, spent not writing, was spent, you know, sort of living. And so I kind of go through, it seems that I'm like writing like on and off, like that seems to be my process that works for me mentally, but it's always changed, I feel like, because life changes. You know, I used to write every morning. I would get up and write, and then I started to become more of a late morning writer, and then I would pretend to write or like write something really bad, you know what I mean? And it always changes, but yeah, I think the big thing is being adaptable and being able to write wherever. You know, some writers are in circumstances where they don't have to change anything. They can just write, you know, nothing in their lives is impeding their ability to write, so they have a set schedule. But then there's other people who are writing holding their baby, or, you know, they're writing, you know, on their way to work when they're in the subway. But I always admired the writers who have like really weird ones. Like, wasn't it John Cheever who would like take the elevator down to like the boiler room, and like he wore like a suit and he would just sit there and write? There was this other woman, this writer, she was a woman, I can't remember her name, but she had a room with black tarps that hung, and she would just go in there and write until she like couldn't take it anymore. It was like almost like a sweat lodge or something. Yeah, it's very strange, the habits we develop. But I don't do anything like that. For me, it's like just the only thing I need, the only thing I need for some reason is like white noise. Mm. I do not know why. I think it's because for the past like 5 years, I would bring my wife to work. I'd come home on the days I wasn't teaching, and I would do laundry, and our laundry was right below us, and I'd hear the washer and I'd hear the dryer while I was writing. And so now in my office, I turn the fan on, or I have headphones in with just a dryer noise on YouTube. I have the dryer. So I feel like I can write anywhere as long as I have a plug in a dryer. But yeah, getting the words down is the most important thing. It doesn't matter how you do it, as long as it's finding the time to do it. And to bring up Rick Bass again, I remember he, in an interview, I think it was when he, I don't remember when he said it, but he was basically like, if you write a page a day, that's 365 pages a year. You know what I mean? Like, that's like a manuscript. And you might be like, well, it'll be a good manuscript, I don't know. But I mean, but really, that's a lot of pages. And so, you know, just, I mean, he started out as a geologist, and he worked, you know, looking for oil, and he realized that he hated it. And on his lunch breaks, he would just spend 30 minutes writing short fiction. And then he lost his mind and moved to the Yaak Valley, and has lived there ever since. And he writes in a shed outside, even in the winter months when it's just freezing. So,
Flaubert could spend the whole day just getting one perfect sentence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rick Bass story. When he went to school, he had taken a creative writing class as an undergrad, but he was in sciences, so he didn't know very much about writers and stuff. And I guess when he said he first heard Flaubert, he thought it was like a Native American chief. Flaubert. He didn't know it was a. He didn't know it was a writer. He didn't know it was a French name. He's a funny guy. He's a funny, very nice guy. What was the other story I wanted to tell? I could tell you about Rick Bass. He wears suits that are too big for him. That's all I know. But he's a good guy.
Actually, that brings up something I'm so curious about. Like, it sounds like, I mean, so much of your work is based on like your childhood, your family, your culture, your setting, your like observations, the things you read, and then you went to grad school, and you sort of learned in like an MFA program, and now you're teaching in an MFA program, and you're talking about like these writerly things. So I just wonder, like, how do you reconcile that? The differences? Are there differences? Do you go into a different mindset when you're writing versus teaching writing, or even having been a student of writing?
Yeah, so my approach is, like, when I'm writing is, like, I don't know what this piece will be. This piece will tell me what it wants to be, as long as we're paying close attentions to, you know, what we can dedicate or, like, actually say are principles of writing, of fiction, you know, character, setting, tone, you know, or diction, you know, all these things that have to be there. And in class, you know, I teach, we look at stories and we come up with theories for how something's working well, why we're feeling a certain way. But I tend to be, you know, this is why I find teaching to be so difficult, is because I always tend to work one-on-one with everybody, to a degree. Like, I'm very much involved with their writing, and I'm always frank with them. I'm like, I don't think you know what this wants to be yet, right? And it's almost like me and that writer are having a conversation about writing, but we're having a conversation about that piece and trying to figure out how we can talk to it, you know, looking for moments together. Because that was what my first teacher did for me that I had. He worked very close with me, and he was like, now look at this. And he's like, look at, you know, this paragraph here. And he's like, think about what's not here and how if you put what's not here, it'll affect the other parts, right? So it's sort of, you know, speaking to you in that way. And that's how I approach it with my mm-hmm. students, is like, being like, we can, there's a logic here, you just have to figure out what it is and how it works.
Mm-hmm. So do you think you would be where you are now if you hadn't gotten an MFA? Can you?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think it probably would have taken me a lot longer. I just, you know, being able to work with the writers I did was really, really helpful. And, you know, I think when I went into the program, I know, like, they were always like, oh, you're already a very good writer or whatnot, and I didn't really see it that way. Like, I feel like I learned an immense amount by working one-on-one with Rick Bass, with Kara Hoffman, with Aaron Hamburger, who were the writers I had there. And I don't know, I think it just sort of sped up the process a little bit. You know, it's like at the airport when you get on that
the
yeah, it's like you caught one of those, a little boost. But yeah, I think the MFAs are good for writers who are ready for them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I have to go to work.
No,
I'm
not
sorry.
Oh, oh. I'm very
thank,
sorry to
thank
hear that.
You very
yes,
much.
Thank you for
it's
being
wonderful.
Here.
Thank you.
Take care.
Excuse me. And how about with your editor at Tin House? How is that relationship?
It's good. She, you know, it's when we did the story collection, she was I had done so much work to the book already that she was kind of like, we don't really have to do anything here. The big thing was, is when I sold the book to them, it was 10 stories, and they were like, do you have any more? And I sent them 4, and they chose 2, and they were both D stories, so that screwed my structure up back and forth. So we had to figure out how to like put those in without breaking anything. But I did novel edits with her, and she went to town, like she like was moving stuff, and it was the same book, I recognized it, but I was like, she was able, this is why editors I think are so important, or working with anybody who has a good eye, is they'll help you see they'll help you see the logic of the story. And, you know, I looked and I was like, oh wow, she really opened this book up by moving these pieces around. And does that take away, you know, I think writers often are like, well, then is it still mine that they did this? And it's like, I think so, yeah. I think it's Ernest Hemingway's The Garden of Eden that was published after his death. It was only half done. And Tom Jenks, who is the co-founder with his wife of Narrative Magazine, that's where he became really famous, because he was at whichever publishing house at the time when the head editor there was like, here is an incomplete version of The Garden of Eden. He was like, finish it. And you're kind of like, how do you finish somebody else's book?
Yeah.
And Tom wrote about it on Narrative Magazine. If you look up Tom Jenks, Narrative Magazine, he writes about his experience, and he writes about how, you know, coming back to this idea that story is outside of us, and, you know, he was left half of this manuscript, and he basically says, he was like, Hemingway left all the tools here. He was like, I just had to figure out how it worked. And it's just fascinating. And so my work with like, that's how I value the work with editors, is because it's like someone better than me is coming at the thing to make it better. And so, and it always changes story to story, novel to novel, but yeah, it's good.
I feel like in that process, you have to find the right person.
You do,
because
yeah.
Because you find people that want to impose their agenda on your work, and that isn't helpful. But if they're trying to help you find your agenda, then it is helpful.
Yeah, I've worked, it's never happened at the Massachusetts Review, but it happened at the Stone Coast Review, which is part of the MFA program I was at, where people would send stuff in and one of the editors would edit it and they'd send it back and the author would be like, no, you're not publishing this. You know what I mean? Because the editor had taken their own, they didn't look at the law, they didn't look to make the story better on the story's terms, they went to make the story better based on how they wanted it to be. And not really a funny story, I guess it's kind of funny, but there's this anthology that's very recent, I won't name it just because I won't throw anybody under the bus, but the editor kept begging me for a story, and I was like, I don't have anything. And I wrote this story and I published it elsewhere. And I was like, well, I have a reprint. I was like, do you want a reprint? And he was like, yeah, I'll take a reprint. And I was like, it was like for like $300. And I was like, I'll take $300 if you just want to rerun the story. He took the story and he changed it. Like it was like 4 pages shorter. It was cut and moved around. And I was just counting my money. And I was like, I sold out. You know, I was like, but in that case, I didn't really care. I was like, the story as it was already published. But like, if it had been the first version I ever sent out and the editor did that, I'd be like, no, thank you. I'll pass. But I, yeah, it's in a magazine that maybe people will see one day. I don't know. But,
how do you find the right person? Because I was just going to comment on that too. Have
just
you worked with
them?
Obviously, you have with someone who didn't get what you were doing.
Yeah, I think, you know, the editors who've been at like the big literary magazines in the United States are very good to work with. I've never had bad experiences with any of those editors because they've worked in publishing, in large publishing, and then they maybe have moved on to literary magazines, and they tend to be in it because literary magazines don't make a lot of money. You know, a lot of them are run by volunteers, so they're not in it to write your story for you. They're in it to, you know, make the story as good as it can be with you. And so finding them isn't a hard thing at all. But in the, you know, big one publishing now, it can be difficult. It's like when you sell your book you have hopefully interest from a lot of publishing houses, and then you have meetings with the editors who are interested, and you know, you have, you know, 5 or 6 different conversations with, you know, 5 or 6 different editors about how they see the book, and you sort of get a general sense of whether or not it'd be good to work with them. Like this third book I sold on proposal, I chatted with editors at like several different houses and imprints, and even if they had offered me, you know, the most money, I wouldn't have gone with them because the editor and I just wouldn't have seen the same way. But if you want the money, then you can sell it. Not sell out, but you can take the money and then go and be like, well, we'll butcher this together, you know. But I think it's ultimately what you want, and just being brave enough to be like, no. But I think another good way is to look at the writers you really love and admire, and look in the acknowledgement sections too, and because they usually thank their editor there, and you can't tell, I mean, if they had a good relationship, but odds are if you're reading a piece of fiction that you like and you feel like your work fits with, perhaps that editor is somebody who gets what you're doing. So that's another good way to find editors.
Okay.
I've always wanted to do, there's like, you can like pay someone to edit. You know, there's a bunch of freelance
mm-hmm.
editors out there. I've always wanted to pay two separate freelance editors to edit the same story and then write about it. Like, I feel like that'd be really interesting to see what they would do. And then with my luck, they'd come back with like the same edits, and I'd be like, "Well, shit. There's nothing here."
Well, it seems like so much of that is now an agent's job. Like, they're the ones who kind of try to match.
They do, yeah.
The right editor with your
yep.
work.
Yeah.
But short stories don't always have agents.
What's that?
Short story writers
yeah.
don't necessarily have agents.
Yeah, my agent. Yeah, sure. My agent will only send, like, I don't have her send any of my stories to magazines, with the exception of like Granta, or, well, no, because now I know somebody at Granta, so I just email them, but like the New Yorker and the Paris Review, like those are places you needed an agent to get in, because the New Yorker will just, like, they hire interns just to throw away manuscripts, you know. Their job would be to sit there and take the manuscript that you so eloquently put together and mailed them and or emailed them and then delete it and throw it in the trash. Like, literally, they get paid to do that. At least that's the case with fiction. Poets have a better shot of getting their unsolicited poems published in the New Yorker. I don't know why, but that's true. Yeah. I've heard more success stories of poets getting pieces picked up by them through general submission than I have with fiction. I don't think I know of anybody who's had a piece of
fiction. They do a lot of soliciting.
They do too, honestly. Yeah.
Morgan, can I take
oh.
a picture of the
yeah.
media over there?
Okay.
Okay.
Both of us?
Yeah, just there. So I can, for the library website.
Okay.
That's okay. You want to get ready? Excellent.
That's a great one.
It started as a novel, and then I feared it was just a short story. But then the more I kept going, the more I was like, no, this is a longer story. But again, I was almost like, is it a story? And it wasn't until I rewrote it that I was like, oh, okay, this is a novel. A slow building novel, but it's a novel. I tend to kind of know what it is I'm writing, but it can change at any moment. It can be like, oh, I'm not going to make this up, I'm going to tell the true story, you know, if it's grounded in some sense of reality, that might work out better. Other questions? I don't know what time it is.
So it's 11:10 right now.
Oh, okay.
So if we want to wrap up, I think.
Yeah, any final questions?
Go to the
boat. Hopefully what I said or brought today is helpful in some capacity of working.
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody.